So in the end, we don't really catch them after all. On good days, I think of my heart like one of those frogs. My trauma, my PTSD, my ongoing battles with memories, all the surprising ways the damage rears its head. All of these are the cups we put the little frogs in, or the small hands we tried to use to cover the lip. Still, the frogs escape, not despite their smallness or vulnerability, but precisely because of it. And then Maghrib is called, and as we gather to pray, the frogs go back home to the waters they were meant for.
All the Angry Women by Liz Lenz. Every Tuesday night, I meet with angry women. They don't look angry, at least initially. They look like you would expect Midwestern mothers to look. Mid-waist and heavy sighs. And they don't technically come to this Victorian house in Iowa because they're angry. They are here for what is marketed as a Bible study. But it is really so much more. I choose to think of it as group therapy. I signed up for this class I now lead when I was 25 and angry. In the year prior, my father-in-law had died. My sisters, Becky and Kathy, had been in a devastating car accident, and Kathy had temporarily lost her ability to walk. When she learned how again, she discovered she wouldn't be able to have children. During her long hospital stay in those hazy days when we didn't know whether Kathy would live or die, which no one ever discussed openly, I had to fight my family to keep the man who had sexually abused her for 3 years in her teens out of her room in the ICU. He was married to another sister and told everyone he wanted to support Kathy. When I saw him walk into the hospital waiting room, I went to the bathroom and vomited. Then I drove home and told a friend who was at my house delivering frozen lasagna. She drove me right back to the hospital and made me tell a social worker who told the doctors who barred the man from the hospital room. Across the hospital, far away from Kathy in the ICU, Becky screamed at me from her hospital bed. Even at 20, even while injured, she felt caught between the divisions in her family. Her whole body was in a brace, and each word made her body tense with pain. But she still yelled at me. How could you tell everyone our business? How could you do that to Mom and Dad? How could you? You never know when to shut up. My mother stood in the corner of the room, looking at me as Becky yelled. Maybe another sister was in the room, too. All I remember is their silence as Becky screamed, her voice strong despite her pain. I walked out of the room and shut the door. I could hear her still as I backed into the hallway. No one ever spoke of it again. 2 months later, I found myself on the floor of my living room, face down and crying. I heaved and felt my ribs push into the oak floors. I was angry beyond belief, but I had nowhere to put that anger. The shelves of my heart were full. I walked down the block to a women's shelter in my neighborhood and signed up for a class. I had met the director once at a church I attended. The class advertised itself to women in the church as life-changing. That phrase was written on the cover of all the materials and used by women who'd taken the class. The class itself was almost silly, forcing us to write letters to our past selves, repeating affirmations to each other, holding a baby doll and pretending it was us. But the mantra of the class is, feelings are for feeling, which was exactly what I needed, because I needed to find a place to feel angry. Now I facilitate that class on Tuesday nights, listening as women bring their own anger. It follows them in through the door. Where can I put this, they want to know. Where can I set it down? I pat the cushions next to me. Put it here. The Proverbs in the Old Testament advise that it is better to live in a desert or on a roof than in the same home with an angry and contentious woman. My mother recited this verse to my sisters and me when we would yell and scream against injustices. Our shorts were too short, our voices too loud, slips must be worn under dresses, dishes must be done while our brothers played. The words were used to silence us. The hot, angry bile of our anger was swallowed back down. It made us uncouth and unlivable. No one will want you with all that anger, my mother told me as I angrily packed for college. They hadn't wanted me to go, not to a Lutheran college. They wanted me to go somewhere more Christian, or to just stay at home. It had taken everything I had to apply for school, find a way to pay for it, and then leave. I had been fueled only by anger. Anger was the only thing that made me strong enough to leave the only home I knew. I held on to it and nurtured it every night, reciting my parents' litany of offenses over and over into the dark of my room. I needed to leave. I needed my anger to help me. My mom stood in the doorway the night before I left. I had sewn my own pajama pants when she refused to buy me some. I had cobbled together scholarships and grants when she refused to pay for my tuition. Now, as I loaded up a suitcase with towels stolen from her linen closet and an alarm clock from the guest room, she watched me, saying nothing as she saw me steal from her. Instead, she said, "Stop being so angry. You will drive everyone away." Her voice was calm and quiet. I didn't look at her, instead, focusing on my heavy bag. Her words were meant as a kindness, a gentle warning. It was one she must have learned herself, packing away her own anger, somehow making it all fit into her heart. Every woman in my class walks into the room with a heavy load. They have learned the same lessons as my mother and I. If you are angry, men will run to the roof. They will flee to the desert. Your anger will make you alone. Your anger will render you unlovable. They heft their bag of contraband emotion into their lap. Where can I put this? Our society has a place for actual abusers: jail. There are systems and processes in place to handle them and rehabilitate them. The faith I grew up with demands forgiveness for abusers. The angry women, they must be silent. Abusers have a pathology. They have a system. They have restraining orders and court-mandated anger management classes. Once I heard a news story about sex offenders who had been driven out of their homes by laws mandating that they stay away from schools. A hotel had opened its doors to them so they wouldn't be homeless. Even they had a place to lay their heads. My anger was still homeless. Jesus is a loud table-flipping rage. We speak of men and their rage as if it's laudable. Men just get mad and punch each other and it's over, we say. Women are just bitches. They never let it go. That's because we never can let it go. Because where would we put it? What system? What faith? What institution has room, has patience, has understanding for an angry woman? Sandy, a woman in one of my Tuesday night groups, speaks softly, but carries years of abuse and pain inside her. She told me a story of a group of men at her church critiquing her appearance. That, she said, in a voice that I had to lean forward to hear, makes me angry. And, well, that's just not nice, is it? I pat the cushion next to me. What does nice have fuck all to do with anything? Put your anger here, my friend. Put it on this couch next to mine. I can feel their anger in me. It pulls at my skin and swells my heart. Their anger prickles my skin like so many armies rising to fight. I am angry too. I am angry for them. Angry for me. Angry for all those women in homes with men on the roof avoiding them. I can only facilitate this course once a year. I'm afraid the anger will break me. My mother told me I was angry since birth. Family lore, though, holds I was a happy child up until the moment I wasn't. I would suddenly start screaming inconsolably. You would just have these freakouts, my mom likes to say, smiling, like you just needed to get it all out of you. I have never known if the stories were apocryphal or self-fulfilling prophecies. The day my mother fully condemned my anger, we were in her SUV. We were sitting in front of my parents' house in Florida, which was green stucco, eating Sonic burgers. The lawn, thick and coarse, was studded with my father's plastic light-up flamingos. We had been running errands and talking about my wedding. My mother was angry at me. Angry because I hadn't taken her suggestion of using silk flowers. Angry because I wanted to buy real ones, even if that meant more work. She was mad about the money, too. I was taking some money from my in-laws to help with the wedding, and I was dipping into my own savings to pay for it. This made her mad, but time has erased from my mind the precise reasons why. I said, "I abhor fake ones." The taste of mayonnaise and meat still sat in my mouth. Even before I said those words, I knew they would make my mother snap. She turned off the car and gripped the wheel. The air was still between us. The clicking of the cooling engine seemed like a warning. I held my Coke in my hands. The styrofoam was cold and pliable. I was sweating. I thought I should grab the door. I should leave. I knew something was coming for me. Instead, I turned to face my mother. "You have always been angry," she said. "You have always been angry at me, hated me. Even when you were little, you have always been mad." "This is ridiculous," I said. "How can a baby be mad? It's just a baby. And this is all just about flowers." Even as I said it, I knew it wasn't just about flowers. This was about something else. Something that at 22 I could feel moving underneath me, but I couldn't see. I could feel it shaking the places where I stood, where I sat, and where I lay down, but I could not name it. My words made her eyelids twitch. She wasn't looking at me. Her jaw clenched and released, clenched and released. I opened the door and got out. For the rest of the day, I vibrated with my mother's rage, which hung over us until I left to go back to Minneapolis and finish planning my wedding. We had real flowers, hydrangeas and roses. I now know that the moment in the SUV, between the smell of our greasy burgers and the swish of the watery Coke left in our styrofoam cups, was the world of my mother's anger, a vast world that involved many small pains and even more large ones, grief, anxiety, and the secrets tucked in between. Her mother was there too, looming somewhere underneath the stack of white napkins or the straw wrappers on the floor. I can only guess at what else was there. Her own marriage, her own fears and private losses. She had nowhere else for them to go. So here they came, tumbling out in a conversation about fake and real, hydrangeas and roses. "Why are you so angry?" a boyfriend demanded of me once. He listened to Korn Metallica, raging with his music as it blared in the dorm room. I loved to blast out Green Day's Minority, screaming out, "I don't need your authority, down with the moral majority." He had thought it was funny, and quaint even. My rage on a playlist was cute. My rage in his face when he made fun of the vagina monologues was not. "Whatever happened to you, it's not enough for you to be this pissy," he said. We broke up the next week. Years later, someone would email me after reading an article I wrote. "Whatever you're mad at," the emailer explained, "someone else has it worse. Why are you so mad? You don't get to be mad." Anger is always reserved for someone else. And yet, I've been in a room with a woman who escaped a war, who lost her father in ethnic cleansing, whose mother burned her hair, whose cousin raped her. "What right do I have to be angry when I'm alive?" she said. Anger is the privilege of the truly broken, and yet I've never met a woman who was broken enough that she allowed herself to be angry. An angry woman must answer for herself. The reasons for her anger must be picked over, examined, and debated. My anger must stand the scrutiny of the court of law, of evidentiary procedures. I must prove it comes from somewhere justified, and not just because one time some man touched my sister, or because at one time some man touched some woman and he will continue on and on. Or because my pay is unequal, and the pay of women of color is less equal than mine. Or because I had to have my husband tell my parents to stop forcing me to meet my sister's abuser for a reconciliation meeting, because they wouldn't listen to me, because my angry vagina rendered me mute. I used to imagine I killed that man. I imagined it in different ways every night before I went to sleep. My anger soothed me. But in my dreams, it was his turn to kill me. Angry women are always the villains. A betrayed Medea sacrificing her children. The product of her womb, the only avenue of her control. Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction, boiling bunnies and lashing out with a knife. Bronte's woman in the attic, burning everyone and everything with her rage. In Domestic Tranquility, F. Carolyn Graglia asserts that when she was a feminist, she was angry and unhappy, and submitting to gender roles made her tranquil and at peace. At Baptist summer camp when I was 12, a counselor dismissed Virginia Woolf as just another angry woman. Our anger undermines us. Why else would we try so hard to get it in check? Hiding tears in an office bathroom, clenching our jaws in SUVs with our mother, smiling tight, white, desperate smiles at the men whose words and hands crawl up our legs. My own family stopped speaking to me for a year because I was too angry about my sister's abuse. "We can't talk to you when you are like this," one of my sisters told me over the phone. "Why aren't you like this?" I asked. "Anger is never the answer," she said. A few weeks after my family stopped talking to me, my parents celebrated Christmas with the man who abused my sister. In the NFL, men who are accused of rape and domestic violence soon make their way back to the field if they are ever required to leave. The angry women are never allowed to be anything more than the shrill cries from the sidelines. Forgive the abuser. The only solution for female anger is for her to stop being angry. And yet, when Jesus flipped tables in the temple, his rage was lauded. King David, railing to the heavens to rain fire on his enemies, is lauded as a man after God's own heart. An angry man in cinema is Batman. An angry male musician is a member of Metallica. An angry male writer is Chekhov. An angry male politician is passionate, a revolutionary. He is a Donald Trump or a Bernie Sanders. The anger of men is a powerful enough tide to swing an election. But the anger of women? That has no place in government, so it has to flood the streets. So every Tuesday, I sit with a chorus of angry women. Together, we learn our brash harmonies. Angry women fight. Angry women care. Angry women speak and yell and sob their truths. In the class, we hold baby dolls and talk to them, learning how to talk to ourselves again. We write letters to past versions of ourselves, giving those little girls a chance to yell and rage. Sometimes I have to hand out a list of feelings. Use this list to help identify what you feel, I say. In my 6 years of helping with this class, I have found that, despite the advice for men on the internet, women are actually very good with the facts of their lives and not with the feelings. You have to name your feelings, I tell them. We all wince a little even as I say it, but I make no apologies, not anymore, anyway. My words may sound like New Age bullshit, but whatever else belongs to us, whatever else we own, we should be allowed to name it. That gift was given to Adam in the garden. It's the gift I try to give to the women in this cold, drafty room in the century-old mansion that now houses those of us who are tired and broken and angry. So far, no one who has come to the house has retreated to the roof or the desert. I asked the woman who founded the house if she knew she'd just be opening the doors for a bunch of angry women. She laughed. I needed a place to put my anger to. I did it for me. So here is a type of Eden, where the creations we name were made in us long ago, before we were even born, anger sliding on down through the double helix, handed down from our mothers. We put our anger down, the tidy packages, the stolen suitcases, too tired to care if we are chasing anyone up to a roof or a desert. Sometimes I wonder if the Proverbs weren't an admonishment of an angry woman, but a warning about the depth and breadth and scope of her wrath. A woman's anger needs the whole house. Go somewhere else, anywhere else. Her anger is not going away.
Good Girls by Amy Jo Burns. The truth no one told you is that in order for a good girl to survive, she must make some things disappear. You know because you used to be one of the good girls. You used to know how to forget. But the truth you're trying to tell yourself now is that you don't need to be good. Not anymore. You need to be seen, and in order to be seen, you need to let yourself remember. You were walking alone in the woods on the afternoon that you remembered the name of a man you'd sworn to forget. 12 years had passed since you took that vow as a 10-year-old, and this name belonged to a man whose secrets you'd once known well, though he'd only ever known one of yours. He'd been the only piano teacher you'd had, and you just one of his many pupils. Back then, you'd been one of his good girls. Back then, he'd been teaching you how to make some truths disappear. In the fall of 1991, 7 of your fellow students in Western Pennsylvania defied their good girl graces when they came forward to admit your teacher had put his hands on them during their lessons, touching them softly to the beat of the metronome. You, though, feared the consequences of telling the truth more than the burden of staying silent. Your indoctrination into the sorority of good girls had begun long before your piano teacher ever put his hands on you. Good girls knew how to keep a smile at the ready, lest you be called conceited, how to turn their homework in on time, lest you be called lazy, and how to keep their mouth shut, lest you be called a troublemaker. Those of us who chose to stay silent didn't need to be told to do so. There was an ungainly rhythm to the response to the accusations, the way his denials drowned out their honesty, and the way an entire town was outraged, but not on behalf of the victims. Parents, teachers, and even fellow students called this man a casualty of a conspiracy plotted by girls. Good girls like you, whose backpacks were filled with permission slips and retainer lids, whose heads were full of spelling words and state capitals. Much of the furor spread not because a crime occurred, but because these girls had the nerve to say that it had. A good girl is a quick study, and this is what you, always a good girl, learned. It doesn't matter how good you are, because a man will always be better. The people of your hometown, small in size and big in illusion, prided themselves on being a virtuous community with righteous men at the helm. Your piano teacher was a member of the town's most potent clique of leaders, men who taught science and math to elementary school children, coached a varsity sport, and played the church organ every Sunday. To attack or question one of those men was to criticize the town itself. And you didn't dare blaspheme the only place you'd been taught would protect you from the rest of the world. You were just a girl, after all. Maybe you were, in fact, predisposed to fantasy, just as these men who fought in wars beside each other and hunted deer back to back assured themselves that you were. You knew that a girl, even a good one, was at best an unreliable source, and, at worst, a liar. After word spread about who had snitched, those girls who weren't you sat alone at lunch tables, were cornered by other students after school, and had to sit in the classrooms of teachers who'd donated money to the piano teacher's legal fund. One young woman's family eventually left town because the environment had grown so hostile. Another was your best friend. She didn't know that you had lied when you said he hadn't touched you. You didn't dare tell anyone, not her, not even yourself. You knew a good girl has to forget in order to survive. Another lie you were told is that the passage of time will blunt a wound. But by the time you turned 18, the weight of being one of the good girls made you buckle at the knees. Too many smiles, too many secrets, too many rules. As an adolescent, you trusted no one. No matter how straight your A's or unscathed your heart, the secret bled you from the inside out, even after you'd all but forgotten what the secret was. There is no path lonelier than the one a good girl forges for herself. Still, you felt claustrophobic in the town that bred crop after crop of good girls, only to surrender their innocence as payment for its fantasies. You didn't want to be named in anyone's ransom note. So instead, you ransomed yourself to higher education in upstate New York, 6 hours from home. Then, on a crisp fall afternoon during your senior year in college, your piano teacher's name flashed in your mind. The good girl in you could no longer contain it. Your memory paid your virtue no mind. The leaves scattering the path that day were bright and fragile, not unlike the ones that folks back home used to rake into piles and burn on the weekends. Your piano teacher's house, and the dark basement where he taught his lessons as he let his hands wander all over you, had been hidden among a crowd of trees. Leaves had always cloaked the path leading to his door on the first days of lessons every autumn. He'd taught students in your town for decades until he finally pleaded guilty and went to jail for a year, the leaves aging from emerald to ruby to goldenrod to ash, and then starting again, welcoming close to 100 students to his basement for half-hour stints at a time. When you began taking lessons, you would have paid a good girl's fortune to be his protege, to stand next to him beneath his spotlight. By the time you finished taking lessons, you had. As you stood in the forest, you felt the snarl of his name on your lips, and you jolted at the memory of the day his hands discovered your body. It was hot that summer afternoon, and you'd just gone swimming before heading to his house. You'd signed up for summer lessons with him, hoping to improve for next year's recital. That session began just like every other. You warmed up your fingers by playing music scales and then traveled the keys, unsure and timid. Then you felt his hand creep under your armpit toward your breast, a silken, gossamer motion. You arched your back in alarm, but you kept on playing, just like good girls should. The song ended, and he took his hand away. When the lesson finished, you ran out to your mother's waiting car, and you drove home with the windows down. You ran your fingers through your hair, still damp with pool water. You kept taking lessons, and you never said a word. Before that day in the woods in upstate New York, when you couldn't not remember, you hadn't thought much about your old piano teacher, even if you still felt his influence. But soon you discovered that when you first try to be honest about what happened, telling the truth feels like re-breaking a crooked bone. Over the years, you'd grown so accustomed to the weight of concealing this man's iniquities that it unmoors you to wriggle out from under it. But you did it anyway, clumsily at first, blurting the truth out to your roommates, a few friends, and even a stranger or two. It was like discovering your own dubious treasure. You needed someone else to see it in order to verify its existence. But no one knew what to say. "I always knew something was wrong with you," one friend admits. "God has forgiven you for lying now that you've confessed it," claims another. "Is this why you don't eat?" asks someone else. "Why is it that women are always blaming all their problems on men?" Blaming your problems on him? It took you 12 years to assign him any blame at all. As one of the good girls, you'd convinced yourself that concealing your piano teacher's indiscretions was the selfless thing to do, the feminine thing to do. That kind of allegation could ruin a man's career, for Christ's sake, but we girls will bounce back. We found a buoyancy in the thrall of a man's world, the pointlessness of it. It took you 12 years to see that being good had gotten your piano teacher everywhere and you nowhere at all. So you decide for the first time in your life that you aren't going to be one of the good girls anymore. You decide that good is not an adjective that ought to be applied to a person, as it only rendered you inanimate and inhuman, like a piece of cheese or a watercolor painting. The good girl is nothing more than a myth. We long for her for the same reason we long for utopia. Neither exists. So you sit down to write about it, and you write and write and write. Writing about it feels like falling through the sky. The day when someone wants to publish it, you land with a hard thump. Yes, you're elated, but you also realize that you can't hide anymore. Everyone is going to know your secret. Everyone will know that your piano teacher put his hands on you and you lied about it. The funny thing is that soon you realize that you actually don't mind strangers knowing. You don't even mind friends and acquaintances knowing. What you're worried about is everyone who still lives in that town knowing. Everyone who is about to find out you're not one of the good girls anymore. Still, when you're asked what your book is about, the same tired awkwardness ensues when you use words like sexual and assault. Words that, when paired together, are dirtier in the mouth than any cuss. You get used to it. That discomfort is why you wrote the book, after all. You spend the summer trying to prepare for something for which you cannot prepare. A voice in your gut tells you that publishing your story will come at the cost of everything you hold precious. The voice sounds a lot like loneliness. You try to combat your fears by reminding yourself why you wrote the book, because silence was not the cure everyone swore it would be. You repeat the mantra over and over, even in the middle of the night while your husband sleeps soundlessly next to you. Part of you hopes once folks from home read the book, they'll understand the importance of speaking the truth, even over 20 years later. But then a few days before the book comes out, word spreads about the crass and selfish thing you've done. You brace yourself. You planned on this kind of backlash. You expected your piano teacher's cronies to come out of their retirement homes to defend their old pal. "Who do you think you are?" you wait for some of them to ask. "You ain't lived here in years." You think you wouldn't mind taking them to task, no matter how public it is. They, however, aren't the ones who come after you. The ones who come after you aren't men at all. They are girls a lot like you, some of whom are the daughters of your piano teacher's staunchest supporters. You didn't expect the backlash to come from women you'd imagined would find relief in your words. You hadn't planned on good girls turning against one of their own. A few days before your book's release, you receive a message from an old member of your cheerleading squad. "You better not have written about me," it says in so many words. "I have people to protect." "You have cashed in on a terrible memory for your own gain," says someone else. "I hope you enjoy the money." "She's a liar," swears someone else on social media. "The truth shall be revealed." Another calls you a coward. Yet another invites you out for a meal, only to tell you you've become the abuser by bringing all this up again. "You used to be one of the good girls," they all seem to say. "When did you go astray?" You go for a walk on the autumn day of the book's debut, and the white sky reminds you of the day you first remembered your piano teacher's hands on you. Now it feels like a new kind of remembering, a reckoning. You tell yourself, "I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I am not afraid." But you are. You choose to accept that you cannot legislate anyone's reactions. Instead, you recognize something familiar in the voices hurling condemnation. They are afraid, just like you. You remember how vicious the mood turned back in 1991. How unsafe it was to feel how you felt. You choose to hear the criticisms, even those that liken you to the piano teacher himself. You also choose not to respond. You still aren't sure if this is the right decision because it only makes people angrier. You give book readings and answer questions. You learn to look people in the eye. Your heart aches for the young women who stay after the events to confide in you, for how effortlessly they understand why you kept your secret for so long. You start to understand why it isn't safe for some women and men to ever share their secrets. Their families will implode. Their livelihoods are at stake. Their marriages may end. This you know. The truth may set you free, but the truth will also cost you. You'll be called brave over and over, which you will hate. No one means for it to sound reductive, but it does. You worry that they don't mean superhero brave, but cancer brave, walk the plank brave. People will also shoot compliments at your husband like Cupid shoots an arrow. "Wow," they'll say, That's some guy you got supporting you like this. Most men wouldn't. And you'll agree and mean it. Your husband is the best human you know. And yet you'll wonder why the bar for his support is so low. Why shouldn't he be proud to stand next to you? Why should he be ashamed about something done to his wife long before you met? After a year, you'll marvel that the book gave your voice back to you. Friends you thought you'd lose because you aren't that good girl they used to know. But you learn that was never why they loved you anyway. You'll receive a few messages from your piano teacher's fellow victims. Some who spoke up and some who did not. And you'll read those letters aloud to yourself until you've memorized them. One woman will travel over 3 hours to hear you read. Another will come out of hiding to stand up for you. Another one will write to say she thinks the book might be the start of redeeming what happened. You'll think, I didn't believe in that kind of redemption, but these women changed my mind. And after the noise dies down and you return to your desk and your quiet life, you'll see that you are changed. Not changed by the book itself or its acceptance or its censure, but by the importance of speaking the truth first to yourself. The invariability of it, the solidity of it, the company of it. You'll write a letter to that good girl who is still stowed away inside you. When you grow older, you'll tell her, you will not get over what happened, but you will reach the other side of it. You will keep it in your back pocket rather than live with it roped around your neck. Soon, you'll no longer miss the girl that you were before that afternoon. There are better things to be than good.
Utmost resistance. Law and the Queer Woman, or How I Sat in a Classroom and Listened to My Male Classmates Debate How to Define Force and Consent. Footnote. In law school, you are taught how to write academic articles for publication in law reviews, which is the art of crafting the perfect title, of making your student analysis of strict scrutiny and constitutional law sexy, of disguising your theory-heavy piece as something that is not too political and therefore not too divisive. You are taught the art of the paragraph-long footnotes that cite obscure case law or define a seemingly obvious word with 30-something synonyms. This is not that. Its edges are not dull and its words arguably divisive, though I struggle to think of any article about rape, legal or otherwise, that is not cause for debate. But we have wasted too much time softening the corners of our speech and blunting our legal arguments to nudge legal reformation to our desired outcome when it comes to rape. We have wasted too much. By V.L. Seek. Footnote. Many legal academic papers criticize the law, but to criticize academia is a different kind of purpose and a different kind of risk, especially when one is housed in its ivory tower. I think of these things when I write under my name. And when I instead choose to write under my pen name, I wonder if I am contributing to the problem or still fighting for a solution. 1. My life at 21 was all short skirts and red wine and big talk about life after college. 22 was a move out west and a first year of law school. Going out but not staying out, annotating case law, and settling into the comfort of a long-distance girlfriend and thousands of miles and a computer screen separating our bodies. My mother never taught me how to knit, but somehow I taught myself and managed to deeply and expertly weave delusion and denial into the threads of the blanket I buried my feet under to keep warm in the new Colorado nights. Yes, it was cold out here, I told my friends, but not as cold as you would think. 2. There must be the utmost resistance by the woman, by all means within her power. State v. McLean. That summer I was 21, just before my senior year in college, I worked as an intern at a prep school in a small town in the Northeast. I took the train up from Baltimore to get there. I was the only person to get off at the stop. The train had emptied in New York and never filled back up, so I'd spent much of the ride staring out the window and romanticizing the upcoming months. My bags were spread across several seats, and I found a safety in the isolation that did not surprise me. My stop had no train station, no platform. I dragged my bags down the steps and found myself facing a one-room train depot and a gazebo draped in patriotic flags. I waited for my cab for 2 hours, thinking that everyone who passed me must know that I wasn't from around these parts. In the cab, the driver offered a knowing sigh when I told him where to take me. We drove up the hill. There were parts of the job that were exactly as I imagined. Taking residents of my dorm to visit the family-owned candy shop in town. Teaching writing to eighth graders already primed to write their college admissions essays. Supervising the 4th of July lawn games and cookouts. That summer was too dry for fireworks. Beholding the steps and rooms, boasting plaques and the names of presidential alumni. But there were other parts I hadn't imagined. The 20-minute walk to the single town bar that we made every night in heels. The spot under the tree where people would go to smoke, steps away from the campus perimeter. Daily breakfast with other interns who would show up with a bruised eye and smile, I couldn't feel my face, and talk about the drugs they took last night. Drinking on the campus was not allowed, and so those of us with IDs and nights off would make that nightly pilgrimage to the one bar. Some nights we came back early. Others we returned with our heels in our hands, and a few nights we took a cab. It was the same driver every time. The drinks were cheap, and I was newly 21. Our last night of work was the first night we could drink on campus. The students had left for the summer, and the halls and dorm rooms were empty for the first time in 6 weeks. A night was planned, starting at a colleague's dorm and stopping by six others that housed us before ending up at the town bar. The crawl was themed, so we spent the day at the Goodwill crafting our costumes. We spent our last paychecks on the alcohol, and I remember that liquor store and that bottle of wine so well. I remember holding it by its neck as I walked from my friend's room to the first party of the night. I remember holding it by my side for group photos, and I remember vomiting it back up the next morning. We got to the first party at 8. By 8:30, my night was over. I never made it to the bar. The next morning, I lay on the floor of a shower stall of that first dorm under a stream of water. The hot water was turned all the way up, but it felt like ice on my skin. I didn't know how many hours I had been on that floor. I was shaking. My underwear was on the other side of the room. I was so concerned with cleaning up where I had been sick. I took off my soaking wet clothes and tried to stop shaking. I wrapped a towel around myself. It was barely the size of my torso. In the mirror, I saw scratch marks on my back and bruises on my chest. I wouldn't notice the bruises on my thighs until later. I pulled my shirt back on to cover them. It was heavy and made me shake harder than before. I walked back to my building and called a security guard to let me in because I couldn't find my key in that bathroom. My friend would return my purse later that day. "You left this behind when you left with..." She trailed off with a teasing knowingness suggesting she did not know at all. I didn't meet the security guard's eyes. I knew he was thinking that I had too much to drink last night, that I had let this happen. For years, that night was my fault. I knew what rape was. I knew what consent was. I knew about first and second wave feminism. I knew queer theory. But I swallowed the blame like that bottle of red wine and repeated to myself the lies that would run on loop for years to come. "You have only yourself to blame. It was not that bad. You're okay. You're alive. At least you don't remember it all. The bruises are gone. You can forget about it. No one ever has to know." Even now, these lies taste familiar, comfortable, in a way that the words survivor and victim never have. 3. In a civil case, the court may admit evidence offered to prove a victim's sexual behavior or sexual predisposition if its probative value substantially outweighs the danger of harm to any victim and of unfair prejudice to any party. The court may admit evidence of a victim's reputation only if the victim has placed it in controversy. Federal Rules of Evidence 412. In the beginning of law school, you have a pervasive idealism about the law. Fresh off writing an essay about justice for all and changing the world using the rule of law for the admissions committee, you are thrown into classrooms with peers who ostensibly want the same. Teachers and debaters, Peace Corps members and journalists. It doesn't take more than a week with the Socratic classes and the formulaic writing and the memorizing of case law for that initial unbridled idealism and passion to slip away. Footnote. This is not to imply that all social justice-minded people who go to law school become corporate defending drones, nor should you infer that all lawyers have subscribed to the ask questions but only so many mindset with which I am familiar. But there is a reason that these are the moments I remember and the people I can't forget. It was harder to think of examples to exclude than to find ones to mention. I, however, clung to the ideal of law school despite my bad grades and the professors asking why I wasn't in law review or mock trial or moot court, despite the classes that I had walked out of and in which I couldn't will my hands to stop shaking. In criminal law, there was an entire chapter devoted to rape. It was my second semester, almost 2 years after I had been raped. Around that time, the debate on the merit of trigger warnings was becoming mainstream, and it was present in our classrooms. My fellow law students were more than happy to chime in with a First Amendment or slippery slope defense. I didn't engage and I didn't care. I didn't reflect on my past experience as it interacted with my present. Trigger warnings were an academic debate, not a practical one. Distilling two pages of facts into a pithy issue is how to define force, note, was how I was going to be a lawyer, not how I was going to finally come to terms with my own rape. We barely got to the second case in class before the questions, repetitive and probing, began to chip away at the protective dissociation I used to stay disengaged. How do we define force? What does it mean to resist to the utmost? How do we define consent? From an evidentiary perspective, can we ask what she was wearing? When can we ask about previous sexual partners, experiences, and proclivities? With each question, each case, and each eagerly volunteered comment, I got colder and colder. I could not stop shaking. The room was 80 degrees, and I was wearing a winter coat. I told myself I was just angry. There was so much to be angry about. The patriarchy, the precedent of rape law, the slow strides of legal reform. I had so many reasons that were not, I was raped. I had so many reasons that were not remembered trauma. That night, I cried while talking to my girlfriend, and I wasn't able to explain why. In evidence, we learned how to discredit a witness on the stand. We learned the exceptions that would allow you to introduce a witness's sexual history to undermine the idea that she was raped. How much did you have to drink that night? Would you say it was your usual custom to dress in this way when going out? And you gave him your phone number? Do you normally accept a drink from any man who buys you one? Did you have sexual relations with him in the past? How many would you say? And all of those times were consensual? Did you ever say no? You didn't scream? And you continued to be in a relationship with him. But it's hard to remember now what happened on that day, isn't it? In ethics, I learned that an attorney who collected money from his friends for a football game was disbarred because he kept the money for himself. I also learned that a senior attorney who repeatedly sexually harassed a female attorney was not disbarred because the court did not consider his daily groping to be conduct involving moral turpitude. In seminars, I wrote papers with facts that would not fade from my mind. Footnote. These facts included, most rapists are repeat offenders. trauma resolution is never final. In 1825, a rape conviction required the testimony from two male witnesses. In rural America, rapes increased during hunting season. And that made me pick fights with my girlfriend because it was easier to accuse than admit. In clinical classes, I talked with my public defender friends who told me how to make witnesses seem like a lying bitch on the stand. In the hallways, we debriefed from classes and criticized our classmates. I've woken up after a lot of drunk sex and regretted it, but I didn't say it was rape, a girl told me. She was my closest friend. It was isolating. Maybe it was re-traumatizing, but I didn't let myself use that word. Trauma was for other people, I thought. And so I did not speak often in class. I had no interest in debating the law, in briefing a case, or commenting on the intersection of trigger warnings and the First Amendment. But law school, the law as it was taught, as it was received, as my classmates minimally questioned it, and as I understood it, was a trigger warning. That night when I was 21 had shifted a bullet into the chamber, and I spent 3 years trying to move away from the line of fire. 4. She must follow the natural instinct of every proud female to resist, by more than mere words, the violation of her person by a stranger or an unwelcome friend. She must make it plain that she regards such sexual acts as abhorrent and repugnant to her natural sense of pride. State v. Rusk. There is an art in deceiving oneself, and I have always liked to be the best at everything. For me, coming out as a queer woman and a rape survivor have been inextricably linked. The way I relied on easy lies to avoid my own trauma was the same way I justified staying closeted. It was always later, or someday, or no one's business at all. But that summer when I was 21, I thought that maybe someday was sooner than I'd initially believed, because there was a girl. I practiced saying the words in front of myself, hoping to see a more honest version staring back at me. Queer. Lesbian. Dyke. The words were foreign, but they came from a mouth that understood them all the same. They felt wrong to say aloud, but my tongue knew the shape to make, and I heard my own truth pouring from a body that had spent years convincing herself otherwise. I wanted to come out. I wanted to speak my truth. I wanted to tell that girl I loved that there was a reason I named every woman in my writing after her. I was in love with her name and the way she laughed at me. I had planned to come out my last year of college, but those plans changed after the summer. What had felt so close to the surface, I once again forced back under. What I had romanticized as speaking my truth became so entrenched in doubt. Doubt about my identity, about that night, about whether it was all worth it. I was committed to shame because it was familiar. I was terrified about the questions of the men I had slept with and dated. And what about all of them? I was terrified that someone would somehow know I was raped and tell me that was why I was gay. I was terrified that it was true. The shame and doubt that I struggled with about my sexuality was easily transferred to my trauma. I am not surprised by the statistics that show an increased rate of violence against queer people. Nor am I surprised that 46% of bisexual women face such violence, as compared with 14% and 13% of straight and lesbian women, respectively. The culture of shame and silence surrounds survivors of sexual violence, but also queer people who are so often considered other. How did I know you were gay is another version of Can I Believe You? When your truth is so inherently questioned, it is easier to say nothing than anything at all. I know this because I live in a bastion of liberalism. I have aligned myself with open-minded people. I've spent my life devouring queer feminist theory. I've spent years in therapy, decades in yoga, and months in meditation to grow and heal and understand. And yet, despite everything, when I write about that night, I still worry if my story is believable. 5. If I were trying to convince you of legal position, this is where I would conclude. I would summarize my arguments, allude to the case law, and propose a workable solution. But a conclusion seems out of reach when we are still stuck debating the facts, deciding whom to trust and what is true. We are trapped in a legal system that has never favored women and has never believed survivors. And we are mired in a circuitous and damning dialogue, so powerful that it invalidates our experiences, our traumas, our truths. A dialogue so powerful that we begin to doubt whether our experience was ever there at all.
Bodies Against Borders by Michelle Chen. Sexual violence is a global epidemic that is all around us, yet it is nowhere, precisely because it permeates every facet of our presence in the world, echoing throughout our political and popular cultures, ricocheting off the cement walls that define our boundaries. My exposure to the concept of rape as a global mass phenomenon and the violation of women's bodies at the borders of nation states came the way it does, sadly, for many Americans, through news articles, the antiseptic analyses of humanitarian field reports, sociological studies. And while my journalistic work often takes a critical look at issues of sexual and gender-based violence, it's often from a distance. Perhaps the price media workers have to pay to get close to a story is learning how to emotionally detach from the subject. The subject is what I wanted to revisit in this essay, the flip side of treating victims or survivors as subjects of a narrative is that the process of intellectualizing the issue also requires neatly transmuting the subject into the object. And objectifying people who have lived through sexual violence is not a good place to begin or end any story, not our own and not theirs. I know I can never restore the dignity of victims I've never really known. I don't seek to give voice to or ventriloquize on behalf of people rendered silent by politics and projections of our collective social anxieties. When exploring the experience of sexual violation at the border, I do bring my own experiences with gender oppression to my lens, but I don't dare claim the telling of their stories as an exclusive right when, in many cases, the stories are all they're able to carry with them. I'm just trying to explore the territories that are supposed to be fixed, hard, official, and to peer beyond the wall. Maybe then as storytellers, we can reveal real people behind those enemy lines, reveal our families in the gaze of the alien, and witness the wars being waged within, as nations trade bodies for political power and rob people of the right to own themselves. Unmoored and in flight, the refugee is vulnerable to every kind of harm, from homelessness to fraud. But sexual violence is the most intimate and most public act of brutalization, and it erupts wherever laws and social norms are unraveled. As transient bodies drift in search of sanctuary, gendered violence can buttress a social taxonomy of dominance and oppression, demarcating the rapeable and those with the power to rape, siphoning spheres of male and female captors and prisoners. Or it can create new hierarchies between the host nation and the uninvited asylum seeker, the occupier and occupied. National borders are the floodgates of the body politic. Once one boundary has been crossed, all other thresholds get a little thinner, the flesh is pricked, the periphery easier to penetrate. The currents of mass migration have both pierced and hardened social divisions, in ways both unnervingly familiar and unimaginably violent. But some form of patriarchy persists across and between every border, even in a space of lawlessness, whether it originates from the actors in a military conflict, aid agencies and religious institutions, or the corrosive poverty exposing migrant communities to the most savage form of theft. The place where sexual violence is most readily weaponized is the one where other social instruments have become unhinged, the interface between two societies. Sexual domination, a familiar pillar of every nation-state's culture, fills the liminal spaces opened by mass displacement. The world is covered in 65 million official recognized forcibly displaced people, an unprecedented population flow since World War II, ranging from school children fleeing alone as unaccompanied minors to wearied exiles who have waited indefinitely